Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Joe Moore.
Well, hello and welcome. Perhaps no other journalist or author has done more in recent years to expose the dark secrets and hidden truths of life in the central San Joaquin Valley than our guest today, Mark Arax. A Fresno native and former senior writer at the LA Times, his 1996 book, In My Father's Name, was a probing and personal investigation into the 1971 murder of his father and an indictment of Fresno's culture of corruption, extending to the highest levels of the city's police department. His 2003 book, The King of California, exposed the secretive life of South Valley land baron and agribusiness pioneer J.G. Boswell. Mark's most recent book, West of the West, is a wide-ranging collection of essays on topics ranging from corrupt land developers to the last generation of Dust Bowl migrants. Mark joins us in our studio today. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
It's been about 15 years since In My Father's Name was published. That's been a personal odyssey for you. What has changed in that time? The response that you received 15 years ago, do you get a different response in the community today after that controversial book?
In the 15 years since, I mean, the case was actually solved, which was something that none of us expected. The publication of the book kind of dislodged some secrets. Some people came forward. And so we actually had a trial almost 30 years after the murder of my father. And actually the last story in West of the West is the epilogue, really, to my father's story. So, I mean, personally, you know, there's this whole idea of closure. You know, I think that's closure is kind of an overrated notion. You never really close something like that. You put it to rest. It's the one event that shaped my entire life, and I think I'm not sure it turned me into a journalist, but it kind of turned me into the journalist that I became.
We're going to talk about a lot of things today. Spend a good deal of time talking about education, some reporting that Mark has been doing in recent days. But before we get to that, I want to talk a little more about the Valley and some of your earlier works. The King of California, a book that a few years ago generated a great deal of attention throughout California, focusing on J.G. Boswell, West of the West, looking at some of these hidden aspects of Valley life, in part documenting some of the issue and what you reporting you did back in the 1990s on Operation Rezone. The Valley is a place of some truths that seem to be right underneath the surface that people know about, but things that people don't readily talk about in their everyday public discussion, maybe in private. What is it like being the person who brings those truths to light in terms of the scrutiny that puts on you?
I've got a very good neck constantly looking over my shoulder. No, when you talk about the books, really I started kind of with Fresno. Although that first book was a journey back to my grandfather's story, a journey out of genocide, the Armenian genocide. And then I moved farther out, with J.G. Boswell. It was really the story of how the South came West. The cotton plantation was taken out of the South and transplanted onto a corner of California, all the way down to the mint juleps that were brought here. And then the last book, West of the West, I even go beyond the Valley and explore all of California. So each book has been a journey. I've never thought of myself as an investigative reporter, someone who exposes things. I've just thought of myself as someone who digs and has a lot of questions and tries to figure out a place. And the Valley has been a place of eternal mystery to me. You know, I was born here. I left for a decade, came back, but I'm still trying to puzzle this place out. It is an incredible place for storytelling. It's a place that's singular in the American landscape. We have done something here that no culture in the history of man has ever done. We created the most intensive, fast-moving high-tech agricultural machine that that mankind's ever known. And yet we are almost embarrassed of it, I think because maybe people don't see it as hip. It presents us as kind of hayseeds to the outside world. So we haven't really embraced our own identity. And because of that inferiority complex, you see it play out in all sorts of realms. So there is a paradox at the heart of the valley. You know, we do end up coming up the worst in a lot of stuff. Our air quality is either the worst in the country or the second worst, depending on what year you look at. Fresno County produces more crops, more food than any single county in America, and yet there was a study came out a few weeks ago saying we were the hungriest spot in America. I mean, what could be more of a paradox than that? And then you look at we have the most concentrated poverty in America. New Orleans is number two, the highest IV drug use per capita. So it's a place that has a lot of dysfunction to it. And so that you don't revel in it as a journalist, but it gives you a tremendous amount of turf to kind of go and explore.
Is that what's brought you back to the Valley?
Well, what brought me back to the Valley was, I was at the LA Times and I came back to write the book on my father, and then my editor said, you might as well stay there. It's a fascinating place. And so I became the LA Times bureau chief in the Central Valley, actually the San Joaquin Valley. I covered everything from Bakersfield to Stockton. And I just pursued all these questions that I had, and I almost reported on this place as if it was a foreign land. And I explained it to readers in LA as if it was a foreign land. And in ways, it is a foreign land because this is a piece of California. It's not just a piece. It's the biggest stretch of it that's been exiled from the rest of the state. We're kind of geographically exiled. And and that geographic exile translates into all sorts of other kinds of exile. We're not accountable like other places are. We have this kind of these systemic problems and corruptions that extend over a century, never get cleaned up.
We're talking with journalist and author Mark Arax today on our program. We'd like to hear from you. If you have a question for Mark, you can call us right now at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. Also online at talk@kvpr.org. West of the West, the title of your most recent book, I find it very fascinating as I understand it. That comes from a quote from Theodore Roosevelt. I've often heard people describe the Fresno area, the Central Valley, as a frontier town, a frontier place. Is that still the case here in the 21st century?
Teddy Roosevelt said, "When I'm in California, I'm not in the West, I'm west of the West." And that kind of captured the spirit of that book. I was going to every place in California and trying to find kind of the hidden story. In some cases, the not-so-hidden story, but one that really hadn't been told. We are, if you wanted to divide up California, they say you should divide it up in 2, 3, but actually it's 5, 6 places distinct. And every place has a drama that comes out of the land. I was in Humboldt. I had a story called The Highlands of Humboldt that really examined just the how wide open the marijuana industry was in Humboldt. In the Valley, I had a story called The Summer of Death of Hilario Guzman, which was a story about where I followed a family of Trique Indians from one raisin harvest to the next. So each place had its own kind of drama, and I was telling the story where the intersection of people, history, and then the land itself. I think that's the thing that distinguishes a writer out in the West from a writer elsewhere, is in the East in particular, is that the land is almost a character in storytelling in the West. If you look at Steinbeck, Stegner, Saroyan, Didion, the landscape is always there and it has to be accounted for.
We have an excerpt that Mark recorded a few months ago for Valley Writers Read, another program on our station, from West of the West, and this is the Tale of Armenian Moonshine. Tell us this briefly about this before we get into it.
Yeah, I'm a moonshiner. My great grandmother was a moonshiner. It's part of we call it part of our religion. So, every January we get together, I can't tell you where, and we brew some batches of raisin moonshine, Rahi, Ori, 150 proof. We lace it with a little anise, and it's a wonderful tradition.
Author Mark Arax from Valley Writers Read, next on Quality of Life.
For all our big city lust, we still tell time by the farmer's clock. There is a season of bloom, the race between the wind and hail, and the blossom trying to set into bud. There is a season of harvest, though we plant so many different crops that it never seems to end. From the earliest stone fruit in April to the latest table grape in October to the citrus of February and March. Every season comes with its own uncertainty, but no season causes more civic fret than late summer, when the raisin farmer sets down his bunches of Thompson seedless grapes in the sun and prays that no rain will fall upon them. We all pray with him, even though by that time the sky is as foul as the sky in China, and every third kid is on an inhaler, and a little rain would be God's blessing. We are standing near the halfway point in our proud progression from Raisin Town to another Los Angeles. Yet to be caught muttering any supplication but the supplication of a farmer is still a thing of sacrilege. If we are no longer farmers, we once were farmers and might be again if we listen to our hearts.
Author Mark Arax reading from his book West of the West. That story aired in 2009 on Valley Writers Read here on FM 89. Mark joins us in our studio today. You're writing about a valley that's rapidly disappearing and that eternal tension between perhaps the two biggest industries in this part of the state, agriculture and development. Are we going to see a valley that's remarkably different? Your kids or next generation, will we even recognize this place anymore?
Well, paving over the valley is going to be a much bigger job than paving over L.A. We have 7 million acres of farmland, so it's going to take a while. But yes, the forces that that transformed Los Angeles are here. The greed is here. The inability of city councils and boards of soups to tell developers no is here. It plays out. We're in the midst of a bust right now, and that bust is fascinating to see, and it's got really interesting lessons. And I think that bust ends up exposing one of the great myths of the valley. Let me tell you a couple stories about growth. I was out driving Panama Road in Kern County, southern end of Bakersfield, not that long ago. And as I drove out that road, it was all ag land 15 years ago. And there were something like, 8,000-10,000 lots that had been gutted, curbed, and electrical things were put in for homes. And every one of those lots were covered in tumbleweeds. And I drove a little further out, and there was a supposed to be a country club, a magnificent country club community out there that I think Greg Norman, the golfer, had designed. I've forgotten its name right now. It's escaped me. There was the golf course. I walked it. I walked the fairways, the greens. They had the ball cleaners there on every tee, but it was covered in tumbleweeds. And I went to the clubhouse. The clubhouse was half built. And I walked inside, and you looked up, and there were these great white stains on the sides of the wood. And you looked up, and there were these huge owls that were living in this clubhouse. And those were the white stains were their droppings. And I thought, my gosh, what were we smoking during this period of time? Who was going to move? Tens of thousands of people, who was going to move to the butt end of Bakersfield into a $400,000, $500,000 house? I mean, what was sustaining that but just incredible greed and some kind of delirium? And so when you look at growth in the valley, you And I've spent 15, 20 years doing stories on it. The last time we had a boom and bust, I looked at the boom we were in the middle of, and I couldn't figure out why the towns weren't that well off because we were growing and growing. I remember in Fresno, we had a development director named Al Solis, and every month he would brag about how we had set a new record for housing starts. And yet the city coffers were no better off than they were before. And so I did a study. I took a look at Bakersfield, Visalia, Fresno, Modesto, and Stockton. And I essentially did, I took a ledger and I saw all the things, all the credits that you could give to growth, everything that accrues, property taxes, sale taxes, everything. And on the other end, I looked at the costs of growth, the infrastructure costs, schools, parks, waters, police, fire, all of that. And I basically found that for every dollar that growth brought in, you had to spend $2 over the long term to service the growth. So growth was a dollar loser at every turn. And the way it was sustained, it was basically a giant Ponzi scheme. Every project was a loser, okay? But it gave you enough immediate cash, front-end cash, to make it look like it was all right. But in the long term, it was going to be a loser. So if you kept approving these projects, okay, you could cover the loss from the previous project. But the problem is at some point, the pyramid has to collapse, and that's what happens. So right now in the Valley, we have these towns that are, and Fresno is one of them, that have taken out a bunch of bond debt to subsidize these developers. And now they don't have the housing starts to pay for the bond debt. And so they are, they're literally eating the subsidy.
You just joined us today on Quality of Life. We're talking with journalist and author Mark Arax. We'd like to hear from you if you have a question or a comment. Maybe you've read some of Mark's books or his various publications over the years in the LA Times and others. You can call us right now. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. We also want to talk about education today. And I know that's something that's been the focus of much of your recent attention and research. This is an issue that certainly is at the forefront of everyone's mind right now. Budgets are being cut. Performance standards are been the buzzword for the last 10 years or so. What particularly brought you at this point to education right now?
Education's a very exciting topic right now. All things seem possible. Charter schools, huge education reform, this documentary, Waiting for Superman, all sorts of stuff. There's just a lot of possibility in education. My sister became the school board president in Fresno, and I kind of helped her with her campaign. And I started, poking around education issues. I'd never reported on education for the LA Times, never really paid all that much attention to it. But I started digging in a little bit, and I think I've kind of taken a journey over the past couple years as a writer looking at education. And I've chosen to study Fresno because I think Fresno Unified School District is a case study not just for the San Joaquin Valley, not just for California, but all of the nation. We talked at the outset of how this valley is singular and how we're often, hold these titles of, worst this, worst that. I think that the Fresno Unified School District, and I don't say this glibly, I think it's probably the most broken school district in the state. And I hope that we could talk about that and I can kind of back that up through the next few minutes. What I started off looking at was a couple years ago, there was a high school in Fresno, Edison High, where there was a grade scandal. And a couple sources, I was finishing up West of the West, and I got a call one day in my office from some old friends at Edison High, and they told me about a scandal that was taking place there where some of the students, they were athletes, were missing 60, 70, 80 classes, school days in a semester, and yet they were still playing sports. And some teachers were changing grades to enable them to do that. So not working for a newspaper at the time, I ended up calling up some of my friends at the Fresno Bee and telling them about that story, and they ended up pursuing it. And it made headlines, but and the superintendent of schools, Michael Hansen, came out afterwards and talked about how he was going to reform this system, and yet he never did. And those absences, I think, were just the very tip of something much, much bigger, a breakdown in the Fresno school systems that really, you know, your story is called The Quality of Life. Really, it's the heart of the quality of life of Fresno. The tragedy at the core of this troubled city is really the collapsed system that is Fresno Unified School District.
Let's go to the phones now and take a call. We have Michael from Madera on line one. Michael, welcome to Quality of Life. Hello, Michael. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes. Do you have a question for Mark?
Yes, I do.
Go right ahead.
In 1849, when Fremont was being guided by Kit Carson over the top of the mountains and looked down on the valley, he said, "I just wonder how long it's going to take people to ruin this most perfect place. It was full of water, animals, trees, blah, blah, blah." And the question is, who owns California now? Who is responsible for the disaster that's occurring all over the state? And relationship to the first view that they got of the valley, saying what a beautiful place it was. That's my question.
Well,
thank you. Go ahead, Mark.
I'm not so pessimistic. I'm not that pessimistic. There is still a beauty here, and you could see it. You know, you venture out 20 minutes outside of the city and you can see it. Some people might consider it an ugly beauty. It's industrial agriculture, but it is a beauty. And yeah, we have transformed. I mean, the valleys, you know, all over the world, valleys have been transformed. And they usually start off, the transformation usually begins with agriculture. Agriculture levels the land and shunts in the water. And we start, you know, making crops. So and now the question is will we take those rivers that have been engines of agriculture and food production, and will we turn them into engines of suburbia? And that's what's happening. In fact, the farmers, and this is one of the hidden stories of the valley, farmers are, you know, as much as they're complaining about a lack of water, a lot of big farmers are selling water to developers up and over the mountain into Los Angeles. So that movie Chinatown is still alive and well.
Michael, we thank you for that call. Let's go now to Lou in Fresno. Lou, you're on Quality of Life with Mark Arax.
Thank you, Mark. I have a question about Tulare Lakebed. How and when did the present owner get title to that lakebed? I don't understand Boswell.
You know, you're wondering how one farmer can own 15% of the Kings River.
He got title to a lake bed.
Well, here's what happened. There was the first Boswell to come west, came out of Georgia. He was chased west by the boll weevil, was ravaging the cotton fields of the South. He came west and was buying cotton for Goodyear Tire. And then was told to go to Tulare Lake. There was a place where you could plant cotton. So with this Colonel Boswell, it's so interesting, they're all colonels when they came out of the South to the West. But this Colonel Boswell started buying up these rights in these early canal companies, the canals that were the first diverters of water out of our rivers. And he bought one canal company after the other until he was able to amass enough canal companies that he controlled or owned, if you can own a river, owning 15% of the Kings River, which flows into Tulare Lake. And then he simply bought the farmland. So that's how one man can control what now amounts to probably $1 billion worth of water on the open market.
And you had an interesting story about how the name of that book or an alternate title for the name of that book was suggested by Mr. Boswell. Can you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, Mr. Boswell, one of the things that I promised him was that he got to read the manuscript before he turned it into the publisher. Now, that's always a dangerous proposition because someone can take offense to all sorts of stuff and want to change it. But I told him we were not obligated to change anything that he objected to. So he read the book in a day and then read it a second time in another day and then called me out to Corcoran and said, I just got a few questions. So I walked into his lanai out there on Main Street in Corcoran, and I looked at the manuscript and it was filled with Post-its. And I said, that's a few questions. Anyhow, he said he had some fact changes. 1956 was actually 1957 or something like that. And we made the fact changes. And then he took offense to a bunch of other stuff. And I told him we're not going to change it. It's factually correct. And then he said, well, here's the deal breaker. I'll never talk to you again if you keep this title. I said, it's King of California. It's a great title. He goes, I'll never be able to walk into the Bohemian Club or and look at anybody again. They'll all make fun of me. I said, well, what title would you think? And he said, well, how about A King of California? And I said, A King of California? I said, you're the land baron of California. I mean, you're the last great land baron. You're not A King. You're the King. Then he says, well, you know, I operate out of Kings County. What if we called it the King of Kings? I said, you know, Jim, I think that one's taken already. I walked out of there and I never saw him again. He kept his promise. He never talked to me again.
We're talking with journalist and author Mark Arax on our program today. You can call us with your comments or questions for Mark. We're also talking about education. We'll get back to that in just a moment. The phone number is 559-275-8989. Or toll-free 800-224-8989. We'll be back with more of Mark in just a moment.
Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore, and our guest today is Valley journalist and author Mark Arax. We're talking about his work and some new work that he's been doing on the area of education. Mark, you said something earlier before we went to break and before we started taking some calls here about Fresno Unified being the most broken school district in the state. Would you care to elaborate on that? That's a rather substantial charge.
It's a bold statement, and I'm working to back it up, and hopefully I'll have 5-10 minutes today to do that. I talked about how there was this scandal at Edison High, grade changes and kids missing 70, 80, 90 classes, and so I started looking at something way beyond Edison, and I found that kind of the second tier of my case, and what I essentially found was that when Superintendent Hansen came here in 2004 to 2005, he basically from his first year to his second year, suspensions and expulsions in Fresno Unified dropped from 27,000 a year to 19,000 in 1 year. And then the suspensions and expulsions today are at 16,000. Now, that is a very telling statistic. What essentially has happened is that to raise attendance and get more money, Hansen has taken the ability to suspend and expel students away from teachers. Basically, there's a quota now at schools, and principals are telling teachers that you cannot suspend or discipline students or expel them for all sorts of real transgressions. We're talking about drugs. We're talking about physically attacking teachers. We're talking about some really scandalous stuff that's allowed to happen. And teachers right now have been defanged, and they're powerless, and they're afraid. I've been interviewing many of them. I'll give you one, for instance, at Scandinavia Middle School, from the first year Hansen was in office to the second, the suspensions and expulsions dropped from 1,231 to 421. So basically he put a lid on it to raise more money because more more fannies were in those seats. And that is something that has emboldened the kind of gangs and the problem kids and rendered the teachers powerless.
Let's go to the phones now and take another call. Greg in Fresno wants to talk about education. Greg, you're on Quality of Life with Mark Arax.
Thank you very much. Mark, I want to thank you for coming on and talking about the issues that you talk about, but I take issue with your comments on the Edison program, and I am nervous and a little pumped up here because...
I like that. Be nervous and pumped up. That's good.
Yeah, but you're taking the Edison program and throwing it under the bus based on an issue that by all means and all rights was a travesty and had nothing to do with education and was actually... We can go on to sports and other programs at universities and everything else, but I think you should also balance your comments with what the Edison program does and where a lot of students end up, you know, going off to good schools, and these are not, you know, necessarily wealthy kids who go to Harvard, Berkeley, Yale, go on to be leaders of our country, and this is because of the Edison program, the Edison High School program, and the middle school program over there. And I don't hear you talking.
No, I appreciate that, and I will. Let me just give you some context. I was simply talking about my evolution as getting into this whole education issue, and it began with that scandal. Let me talk about Edison for a second. It's a very interesting study. Edison brings in a lot of students from the outside who end up. Many of them from North Fresno. They go to Manchester, then they go to Computec, then they go to Edison. So Edison is really the tale of two schools kind of woven into one. If you take out the imports, the kids from the outside, and you take a look at what's happening to the neighborhood kids in Edison, you will see dropout rates that are 50, 60, and 70%. So by bringing in the outside kids, you're masking a very serious problem at Edison High School. And right now, Edison is losing millions of dollars in funding that it could get for those neighborhood kids, economic impact monies, struggling disadvantaged student monies, and they're not getting it because Edison's numbers are the neighborhood numbers are being masked by the outsiders coming in. So Edison High, in a way, is two schools.
No, and I understand what you're going to talk about, but I think you're not. I think you really need to check use your journalistic skills and really check the numbers there, because I can speak to my children who went there, other friends of ours, and they're not North End High. You know, we're working class.
Oh no, I'm not talking about class, but you do come from the outside.
That's what the program is about.
Right. But what I'm saying is. By focusing on Edison as a whole, which is fine to do, we are losing the tragedy at the heart of that, which is the neighborhood kids in Edison. Their experience is much different, and their tragedy is not being addressed in part because Edison High School, if you look at it as a whole, looks very successful. But if you take a look at it and compare outsiders coming in to the neighborhood kids, it's two vastly stark different stories.
You can take that point of view, and I'm not the best spokesman to speak to the Edison program.
And Greg,
I really, other than knowing that I had children that went there and had a good experience. But there was if you go back and look at the philosophy of it, I think it's trying to stay true to the original philosophies that are there, and I think you need to address those when you do speak about it.
Fair enough.
Greg,
fair enough.
Thank you very much for your call today on Quality of Life. We really appreciate it. Mark, we were talking about your accusations against Fresno Unified School District. Some would say, in fairness, that Fresno Unified was broken before Superintendent Hansen came into office several years ago, and that in many areas he's been given rather high marks for turning around a district. At least his supporters would say so. How do you lay blame at his feet for this particular issue?
I think that the school district was broken before. I do think that because we're talking about the most impoverished city in the country, it's a huge, huge challenge to turn this school district around. I think he's been given credit for making changes and turning things around, but when you really look at the numbers, I don't think he's made those changes. Let me give you Bullard High School, for instance, which is my alma mater, and some would say I have a blind eye when it comes to Bullard. But when Hansen came in to take over, Bullard High test scores, when you compared them to similarly ranked schools, were in the 90th percentile. They were among the highest in the state. Today, 5 years later, Bullard High School test scores are in the 10th percentile. I can find no high school in the state of California that has dropped more precipitously than Bullard High School. It went from 90th percentile to the 10th in 5 years under Michael Hansen's watch. And that is a story. They have transferred a lot of outside students into Bullard, which is good and fine, but they never gave Bullard High School the funds to deal with many of these Title I students. They essentially just dumped these students on Bullard without giving them the funds to help them academically because they were more challenged students. So that's one instance of a very stark instance of I see a failure on Hansen's watch.
You mentioned Bullard High School, and in interest of disclosure, as I understand it, you're a part of a group of Bullard parents, alums, residents advocating a different path for that school, in fact, breaking away from Fresno Unified to form its own district. There have been a number of proposals discussed in the media, one of them forming a district with Fresno and Edison, another one, a district, the proposed, as I saw in the B, the Van Ness school district of Fresno High and Bullard High. Is this what's driving that effort?
The research I've done, you know, I put on a journalistic hat when I go do research, and I try not to load up or go in with any preconceived notions. This is way beyond Bullard High School. This is a problem at the heart of this city. The school district is essentially kind of warehousing kids. There are many, many kids. I'm trying to find out the exact number right now. I've requested this information from Fresno Unified. Kids in high schools in Fresno, Fresno High, Roosevelt, who are in their senior years and they have 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 credits and they need 230 to graduate. It's a scandal. We had one example. We had a kid who was mentally challenged at Roosevelt High School a few years ago. A police officer shot and killed him on campus. I think you might remember that case. He should not have been in regular high school. As far back as middle school, I've been tracking his case. He came on campus in middle school with a knife and threatened some people. So that was a kid who was crying out for help, needed to be taken out of the regular school and put into somewhere else. He wasn't. And this is going on many, many cases. I've been tracking a stabbing murder at Sunnyside where a student at Sunnyside or just dropped out killed another student at Sunnyside who had just dropped out. So I've been spending time in these southeast neighborhoods, and it's really sad what's happening. Kids are basically not being identified early enough, pulled out into a school system, another alternative school system that can teach them reading, writing, or vocational education. So, I mean, at Roosevelt High School alone this year, we've had two kids murdered. One was playing on the rugby team, a little 15-year-old named Nicholas Quiroz, who was stabbed to death just a few weeks ago. So this is way beyond Bullard High School, and we're seeing failures at McLean. McLean just lost $10 million in funding because the school district is so big and so dysfunctional that it could not keep McLean on track to just make some minor improvements to get some money, and it lost $9-10 million in this very tough budget times.
Some would say that these are larger societal issues that go beyond the realm of the school district itself. How do you answer that? And what are some of these other issues? I'm trying to, again, go back to your statement earlier that Fresno Unified is the most broken district, in your words.
I said it was I think it's arguably the most broken school system in the state of California for some of these reasons that I've talked about. The charge is a very, very tough one for Fresno Unified because they're drawing from the poorest neighborhoods in the United States, okay? And the many of these children don't speak English as a first language. When McLean High School lost $9 to $10 million, there wasn't a single letter to the editor from any parents at McLean High School complaining about this. There wasn't a single parent from McLean High School going to any board meeting to complain about this. So there is a disconnect between the parents and the district. And part of the reason why is this district is so big, 75,000, that there's a huge bureaucracy between the school and the parents, okay? Most experts will tell you that a school district should not be any larger than 35,000. That's when it's at its most efficient, 35,000 and below. We are double that here. And so I think a case could be made, that the school district needs to be divided in half.
But to follow that line of reasoning, Fresno Unified's enrollment has actually been declining over the years. It was much larger years before, was it not?
Not much larger. It was a bit larger. It's about 75,000 now. And you could talk to Pete Mias or anybody else. Pete Mias a decade ago wanted to divide Fresno Unified School District into three districts. That was his plan. He couldn't get support for it. But it's that bureaucratic, and the fact that they're losing these millions because they're not on top of these situations, I think, makes that case. Okay, and it's a lot of pressure on the superintendent. I mean, I think what I'm seeing from the superintendent is, and I think people were kind of poo-pooing these speeding tickets and things he had, but I think it speaks to he's someone in charge of, is it $1 billion? I mean, it's a huge, huge kind of, bureaucracy. And he likes to control things. And it's very tough to do. And I think you're seeing some erratic behavior on his part. These driving tickets, there are many more that have not been reported on that I've got documented, many, many more. And and I think that will be coming out. And there's a case where, I was able to document where he, leaving a party a couple years ago with his wife, he nearly hit a kid and killed him on a street near the Bluffs.
Those are serious charges, Mark.
Yeah, no, I've been able to document him. I've talked to the family whose child was driving in a three-wheeler and was nearly was struck by Hanson's van. So these are some of the things that I think will be issues in the future. His driving record, his erratic behavior, the child that was almost killed, the father said, the mother is a school teacher, so she did not feel comfortable to report this. The kid luckily only had a minor injury, but that should have been reported, and it was not reported.
We're talking with journalist Mark Arax today on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Education is the subject of his latest investigation. Now, in all fairness, we certainly will work to extend an offer to Fresno Unified to share their side of the story on this. But in all fairness, your sister is on the school board.
Mm-hmm.
Superintendent Hanson works for the school board. These things are not brought up in the board in that context?
I don't think the board knew about his driving record, which is very interesting. I think it was either a dereliction on the part of the superintendent or a dereliction on the part of the board. I'm not sure which. I've not talked to my sister about that. I mean, we erect a wall between us on these issues. But I think they will probably be asking those questions now that that's come out. I think in Bill McEwen's column, it revealed there were 7 tickets, okay? And some of the, and there are more than that. And in some cases, he was driving in excess of 90 miles an hour. So this guy, I don't know how he had a license. It should have been suspended. I'm not sure why the board didn't know, because the board, as his employer, should be getting these pull notices. The DMV basically lets employers know how their employees' driving records are, especially when they're public employees. And for some reason, there was a breakdown there. So he's had many, many driving offenses, serious ones, up and down the state, from Southern California up to Sacramento. And then I was able to document this near accident where he nearly struck this kid who was in his three-wheeler near the bluffs off of Van Ness Extension. And his wife got out of the car and started yelling at the kid and the family. And the family said, geez, who's at fault here? And so, yeah, I was able to document that with the family yesterday.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but listening to your accounting of your reporting of the work that you've done, it seems to me that your issue is less with the district and more with Superintendent Hansen.
No, I think it's both. I think I started off, like I talked to you, with the big picture. I saw something happen at one of the high schools, which it caught me curious why students would be missing 70, 80, 90 days of class. And then I took that deeper and looked at the issues of Bullard High School. Then I looked at Fresno High School, where 4,000 students in the Fresno High community are leaving the Fresno High community and going elsewhere. So I started looking at the larger systemic issues, and then it took me back to the superintendent with regard to these expulsions and suspensions that dropped in his first year from 27,000 to 19,000 in 1 year. Suspensions and expulsions dropped. And when I asked teachers what was going on at school, they said, we are not allowed to suspend or expel. Discipline is a huge, huge problem. And the things that our kids are getting away with, I mean, I had a teacher tell me the other night that a kid threatened her, pushed her, and when she went to call the office, he yanked the phone out of her hands. And then when she moved to get an expulsion, she couldn't get one because her principal had basically been told that downtown didn't want expulsions and suspensions. They wanted to keep a lid on them because those kids in the chairs, that's money to the Fresno Unified School District. So, yeah, I don't say any of this lightly. This comes after months and months of reporting, and you know, I'll probably end up writing about this. I've written a piece in this month's Fresno Magazine on the butt drag, that case out in Buchanan.
And that was Clovis Unified.
That's Clovis
Unified. Fresno.
That's right. That's right. And I'll probably end up writing a piece about Fresno Unified in one of the forthcoming issues of Fresno Magazine on some of these things I'm finding out. And I will do the piece very much like I did the butt drag piece.
And we should say that case was involving an apparent illegal move that bordered on assault in a wrestling, high school wrestling case, for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with that case.
Right, but it wasn't an assault. It was a wrestling move. So the way I told that story was I was a degree or two separated from many people in that story. And so I told it not as a disinterested journalist, but more as a writer, a kind of a curious writer. And I will tell the story of Fresno Unified in the same way. I mean, I cannot be a disinterested journalist with Fresno Unified. One, my sister's on the school board. Two, my brother's a football coach at Bullard High. Three, I've been involved in some efforts to try to reform the school system. So I will tell it as a kind of writer, very much in keeping with my pieces in West of the West. West of the West was a very liberating kind of storytelling for me. It allowed me to bring in essay, reportage, first person, and kind of get at these issues without pretending that I was this distant observer journalist. It's a new kind of journalism. But it's actually kind of a new old kind of journalism, because Joan Didion and Gay Talese and others practiced this journalism before.
The new journalism.
That's what you call it, the new journalism. So I think it's provocative. And what you're doing is you're basically laying out your biases to the reader. You're saying, look, I'm involved in this effort. I have family members that are involved in this effort. But here is what I found. I'm going to lay it out to you, and you can either accept it or not. And hopefully the mainstream media, the one that does operate with strict guidelines of objectivity, will pick it up and take a look and see if there's something there.
Well, Mark, we certainly thank you for being a guest on our program today. Those are some serious eye-opening accusations, and we'll certainly look into those and give Fresno Unified an opportunity and Superintendent Hansen an opportunity to state his side of the story. But
the lines are open, though, huh? There's five of them, but we don't. We're going to leave those people for.
Well, we'll
get their names and numbers.
We have to move on to our next segment, Mark. But thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay,
appreciate it.
We'll be back in just a moment with Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. It's mid-April. That means it's tax time. And we thought we'd devote a segment of our program today to looking a little closer at some of the issues that Valley residents face when it comes this time of year. Here to tell us more, we have Tom Bell. He's a CPA with Moore, Greider & Company. He's a partner in the firm. Tom, welcome to Quality of Life.
Morning.
Tax day comes a little late this year.
Well, yeah. There's
April 18th. That doesn't sound normal.
Well, there's something called Emancipation Day in Washington, D.C., so that gives us an extra weekend to get the things all done.
Now, we can't give out tax advice on the air. That's not the role of radio. But I do want to ask you some questions in terms of what are some of the biggest mistakes that people make when it comes to filing their taxes?
Well, I think the biggest mistake that a lot of people make doesn't really happen with the actual preparation of the forms. It's really the lack of good records. So I think that the preparation really starts with people getting the proper discipline together and getting things together to get the information necessary to take advantage of all of the deductions and the things that are available to them.
And if you have questions for Tom, you can call today at 559-275-8989 or toll free 800-224-8989, or maybe you have a personal tax story you'd like to share. That is, again, 559-275-8989. Many people dread this time of year. One of the concerns that we always hear is the issue of an audit. What is the procedure by which the Internal Revenue Service selects returns for further inspection?
Well, basically, and actually there's three levels of audits. People get confused. Anytime they see a letter from the Internal Revenue Service, they automatically think, well, it's an audit. The three levels of audit that you can get involved with is, first of all, just a letter or correspondence audit where the computer has matched up some item of income on your return and it doesn't quite sync or jive, and so you get a letter. That's usually not a big deal. You just correspond with them and you solve the issue and then they'll move on. The second level of audit that we can get is what's called an office audit, and that's where you go downtown with your paperwork. They usually give you areas on your return that they're looking at, and you have to demonstrate those expenses or whatever to substantiate the position you took on the tax return. And the last level of audit is a field audit where you actually have an Internal Revenue Service person come out to your place of business or to your tax preparer's office and go through and actually substantiate those. But all tax returns, and we're talking about individual Form 1040s, go through the Internal Revenue Service and they're graded. They go through and they get what is called a DIF score, discriminant integrated function. And the Internal Revenue Service takes tax returns and they audit them extensively. to get some ratios and parameters on what they would call the norm, and then to the extent that your tax return doesn't fit into that norm, it gets some additional points. And if you get enough points, you win and you're selected. And then an individual person will look at the tax return so that they can see, are there items on there that they feel would be worthwhile to audit?
Are there red flags in terms of things that people try to get a little too creative in terms of their tax return that would set off concerns about?
Well, as we understand, and it's not really public information on how they actually set this DIF score. But as we understand it, like a Schedule C, which is for trade or business, just the mere existence of that form gives a high ratio to audits. In other words, most of the audits that we do have Schedule Cs for trade or business. And it really shouldn't be magical, because if they make an adjustment on a Schedule C, generally the adjustment is going to be for Social Security or self-employment taxes as well as income taxes. So any change that they make to the Schedule C is pretty much a target-rich environment for them.
One of the concerns that many people have, and it's something that both parties are talking about in Washington, is streamlining the tax code in some way. There's a lot of loopholes. Many corporations take advantage of those loopholes. There's also various credits and things for individuals. Have we seen the tax code become ever increasingly complicated since the last efforts at reform? And I suppose that keeps you in business.
Well, yeah, I Congress is basically our benefactor for us to keep the Employment Act for the accountants going. The 35 years I've been doing this, Congress definitely uses the tax code as a social proclamation as to what, you know, social programs, whether it's contributions, nonprofit radio or whatever, but, you know, homes and mortgage interest deductions. So, I mean, they're using a lot of the tax code to push forward those ideas.
If people don't have their return ready at this point or right by April 18th, what is your advice to them in terms of what options do they have?
Well, basically, April 18th is a deadline. Then you can file an extension. It's an extension of time to file but not of time to pay. So if you owe money on your tax return, you have to pay it by April 18th or you will have a penalty and interest on top of that. So right now, the best thing that I can advise people is to find out whether they believe they're going to owe tax or not. If they do, pay it by April 18th, extend the tax return, and then that makes the due date out to October 15th.
Again, we're talking with CPA Tom Bell from the firm Morgreiter & Company in Fresno about the upcoming tax day. Tom, I really apologize. We have sort of a short segment today due to our earlier guest had some extra information we weren't expecting. So we apologize for the brief nature. If people want more information about that, the Internal Revenue Service has a website, I'm sure, where people can go.
Right, irs.gov. You can just go there and you can get any information from there.
Great. Well, Tom, again, thank you very much for your time today. And that's all for this edition of Quality of Life. You can hear the audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, and production manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.